This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Continue. And if you are listening to WBAI in New York City, or to KWMD in Cassilis, Alaska, or CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, then you're deriving some benefit from listening to WBAI, or some person like you probably has so many other things you could be doing. Of course, if you're driving around the streets of Manhattan or one of the major arteries leading into the city, you might not be able to do too much. I mean, you could always change the station. That is always your option, but please don't, because this morning on Radio Unnamed, well, my name is Bob Fast, by the way. That's Bill Prop over there. And, we have a brass band for you this morning. Jesse Dullman and a gentleman named Candler, whose first name so far escapes me, but we'll tell you before the evening is out. And it is Jason Candler. And don't forget it, because, I mean, a brass band on the radio, live at night. And we also intend to be visited this morning by some people who have been there. Some people who were at the moment of, I guess you can call the sexual revolution the Big Bang. Psychedelic revolution, another Big Bang. The conversion of beatniks to hippies, another big, big bang. Bohemians, the underground, bang, bang. All those things that led us to the mess we're in now. With our oil-soaked future. They had a new camera that they took down to the lower depths. I don't know whether you caught up with it on your TV, but this one sneaked around beside the leak, and you could see that they had put some kind of a lid on it and bolted it down, but the lid was like was not put on properly, and it was like a jar in one spot, and it really, at one point they had these experiments where they had artificial hands doing the actual digging around and playing with the experimental animals. And someone would put their real hands into a pair of digitized gloves, and the robot hands miles and miles away would, you know, choke the rat or whatever it was they were doing. And this is, I mean, what they're doing now is something like that. It's something like attempting to operate the lunar lander, you know. When they put the lunar lander on the lunar surface, it leaned over and fell down like a poor beetle on its back waving its wheels in the air, so they sent up another one. But they had a fail-safe plan, and these filthy, life-destroying oil people, BP, Halliburton, they had no alternative plan. Their only alternative plan was to romance the administrators, the testers who were supposed to be setting up the safety measures. It's really more repulsive than even killing people with drones. It's technology gone completely bonkers. But we have a brass band, and we'll be hearing. The band has a name?
Yeah, the
Mighty Outbackers. Wait, let me turn the microphone on.
There's one. My mic's on. What about your mic?
Okay. Yeah, it's the Mighty Alpacas.
Alpaca?
Yeah, alpacas, like the animal.
Alpacas. Why alpacas? Because, what do you think?
I don't know.
They're mountains. I mean, they travel sure-footedly up and down mountain slopes, and they're called with horns, right? They don't spit like llamas.
Right.
Or do they?
I don't know. I just thought it was a funny name.
Mighty Alpaca. All right. Let's hear the alpaca, what the alpacas. Now, I hope that this isn't going to overmodulate our sensitive transmitter. But we'll give it a shot.
It's got a compressor on it.
Yeah, but that sounds, when it plays through the compressor, everything sounds so pumped and that's
oil-like.
Yeah, oily. Tuba sitting in an agent's office, and the agent says to him, "What are you, hot?" And the guy says, "Nah, sweet." Okay. Thank you, thank you. We'll be hearing more from Alpaca. First, here's. There's one of my favorite modern composers, Yanis Tsenakis, is going to be having some of his works performed in Central Park, and some of the instruments are going to be set up on boats in Central Park Lake, on twin, like, catamaran-like things with drummers and lights, and I think it's going to be a definite must-see.
That sounds great.
This is something by Tsenakis.
Thank you. Time? What time is it anyway? And what are we here for?
Well, it's time to talk about those 50s, 70s, that last century.
It was the last century, but it wasn't the first century.
The last one to talk about.
Brother wrote this book called Down and In. So that wasn't out, that was in. And it's all about what was in then. He actually starts out with the very beginning of the book. He writes, and his name is Ronald Sidney. He's no longer with us, lamentably. I'm sitting in a cavernous cabaret off Bleecker Street near Washington Square called The Open Door, talking to a junkie musician named Tony Pucella, who's playing here tonight. For a while now, in the early 50s, The Open Door is the center of the village scene and the music scene. It books the hippest groups, and jazz men come down to jam after they finish their gigs on 52nd Street. Tony plays a big, mellow trumpet, and he's good, though some people say he sounds too much like Miles Davis. That's the beginning.
And I remember that Open Door. It was a wonderful place. It was a huge, huge cavern of a huge storefront. I believe it was on Green Street, and all of the best musicians were playing there, and Tony Frisella was a wonderful trumpet player. Unfortunately, he was also a junkie and died very young. And I think there's only one LP that I have of his. He has a very short recorded history because his life was very short and very disorganized. Go.
So, it keeps on going because Ron wrote the history of that period, and that period was historicized by the places that were frequented. You know, after the Open Door comes the San Remo at one end with the Minetta Tavern on the other, but the Remo was the place until the Cedar Bar co-opted their space, and eventually Max's Kansas City. And that's kind of the routine with the byways on the Lower East Side and
Stanley's on the Lower East Side and Avenue B.
Absolutely, yes. Stanley's. And some on the West Side. Even in the days of Mr. Poet Dylan Thomas, that famous place which is still there, although it's full of pictures of him, he's certainly no characters like he was exist there anymore.
You mean the White Horse?
Ah, I mean the White Horse. Horse was a... a word which was fairly common in those days, and the White Horse was actually heroin. although it was a bar. One of the things that Ron wrote about had to do with where we are right now, because he did have a penchant for, I'm just looking for the place. Now, the various confrontations with power and violence that brought the flower power of the Woodstock Nation down to the realities of American life, the March on the Pentagon described by Mailer, the Chicago Democratic Convention, the Altamont riot, and even the Manson murders had destroyed some subterraneans like folk singer Phil Ox, who couldn't come to grips with the changed scene. Ox committed suicide in 76. He felt he had been a shaper of society and couldn't figure out how to keep doing that, said his brother. The situation moved others like Jerry Rubin to frank sellout. While some were driven further underground or became like Abby Hoffman and Timothy Leary, actual fugitives, one of the courses that had been opened to subterraneans moving into the 60s was that of creating their own alternative institutions. Black Mountain College, the Commune Movement, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, including WBI, hey, The Village Voice.
Phil Oaks.
What about Phil?
Well, that's, you said Ox.
Oaks. Ox.
Oaks.
I liked Ox. But oaks, you know, oaks have leaves and ox have horns.
He called himself Oaks.
Yeah, you're right, he did. But
and so does his brother, and so does his sister.
Ah, well.
Your name is Gerd Stern, and although I've heard you called Gerd.
Oh,
I always correct people who call you Gerd.
Well,
Gerd.
In Brooklyn they call
Oaks.
They call me Goyd.
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 I tell them it's Gerd.
Right, and there was an Earl spill.
An Earl spill, right. But it's Gerd as in turd. Right. Not Goyd as in Woyd. Or in French, it's Gerd as in Maird. Anyway,
Gerd is the author of what was probably the first electronic poem. And if we're fortunate, he'll recite it for us.
Oh, my goodness. You must be referring to take the no out of now, then take the now. No, that's not it. You see, I'm confused. Take the ow out of now, then take the then out of now. It's such a, you know, it always gets to me because I tell people, take the no out of now, then take the ow out of now, then take the then out of now, and they want an explanation. I mean, what do you have to explain? I know how to explain it. It's take the negative, take the pain, and in English, we have this wonderful thing where then is both past and future. You can say it was then and it will be then, right?
Right.
But in no other language,
and
by
the
way.
In the Tao, we'll take the D out of Tao. No. In the Tao, you take the
T out of India.
you change that to this.
That's good. Take that to this.
Can I say a little bit about my brother's book, which I have just really reread? I haven't read it in a long time, and I found that his earlier works are really quite comprehensible. When he became more experimental, he lost me, but he evidently didn't lose a lot of other people. But one of the things that I'm looking at the book, and I find I'm reminded of kind of what a wonderful century that we lived in. It seems to me that that was a time that was, it was almost a delight to go from day to day. The life was so tremendously exciting. There was so much upheaval and so many new ways of looking at things. That, to me, this book describes that. I just really, you know, I just took the book out again tonight, and I'm just, it's wonderful. There's one part I was just rereading that we used to go to Minetta Tavern when Minetta Tavern was affordable, and we would have this eggplant parmesan and pour a lot of extra grated cheese on it, and it was, Manny was the waiter there, and we would pay 75 cents, so it's like, and then if we had money, we would leave a tip, but generally speaking, we didn't have the money, so we didn't leave a tip, but we would pay Manny later. And Ron describes Manny, and unfortunately I haven't looked at this book before tonight, but he describes Manny as kind of looking like some kind of like a grasshopper, which he really did. He was very thin and huge eyes, and kind of a large nose, and he looked very much like a grasshopper. But anyway, the book to me is really a delight to read again, because I just think it was such a privilege to live through that century. And when I see, when I compare centuries, which I am now at this point in my life able to do, I must say that was one that all you younger people have missed, and you missed out a lot. It was just kind of marvelous. So, Geert, I've had my little say, so...
Well, I wanted to...
You could read some stuff from it.
I was going to say... From page 171, that's for fairly well along. It says, when Bob Fast first heard BAI on the radio, at a time when the furthest out radio got was the wry iconoclast Gene Shepard's Right Show, Night Show, that is. Did I pronounce Shepard correctly? as Shepard's watch.
Go on with your shepherdizing.
Yes. His reaction was typical of many listeners. I couldn't believe it. Really, I don't know what it was that I heard. It was so impossible. Brecht, Bertolt Brecht and Gertrude Stein and on the radio? A children's program on existentialism. I became as very devoted as a listener. But to put the impact of hearing BAI in perspective, you have to go back to Fass's experience at Midwood High in Brooklyn. I wanted to be an actor when I was in high school, says Fass. I don't like this description of you, Bob. It says, a handsome, if somewhat burned-out looking guy. I wrote poetry. I thought all art, in a way, was underground. I wouldn't have put it that way, but it was outside the normal everyday concerns of almost everyone that I knew. Hey, and here you are.
And it still is.
It still is. Yeah, right. Well, you know, even at a later period for Fass, underground meant doing it in the afternoon. I won't say what doing it was, because we're not supposed to say those words on the electric radio, right? Underground men putting a book of poetry inside a brown wrapper. Underground men going to the Stanley Theater on 8th Avenue where you could see Russian movies. Underground men knowing a black person, dating a black person. And it certainly meant jazz. So there we are. Back then. How do we get to now? We got to now on our own steam. And it wasn't just oil either. Although, I guess that's what brought us here.
Thank you.
Alpacas, and we'll be performing this Sunday at a street fair in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. The exact address is 268 Smith Street, which is right near the F or G train to Carroll Street, and we'll be performing at 2:45, but the from 2:45 to 3:45 p.m., but the street fair begins at around noon or so till 5 or 6. On Smith Street in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. Thanks. And again, my name is Jesse Dolman on tuba, and this is Jason Candler on alto saxophone.
I'm gonna play something on recording that I tried to play last week, it's the answer to. To a continuing mystery.
Well, they're trying to get you, Jimmy. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Jimmy, they're coming after you. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Every politician and his brother, too. So now you've heard about all the wars caught in the Iron Sea and so on. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Jimmy, they're coming after you. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Trying to get you, Jimmy. Every politician and his brother, too. Well,
senator from Arkansas has tried to prove Hoffa broke the law. But the driver said, Jimmy, here's our man. And the trucks keep a rolling on across our land. Well, they're trying to get you, Jimmy, trying to get you, Jimmy. Jimmy, they're coming after you. Trying to get you, Jimmy, trying to get you, Jimmy. Every politician and his brother, too. Now, some folks say he'll go to jail. But others say we'll pay his bail. Now we don't know who's right or wrong, but a million drivers will sing his song. Well, they're trying to get you, Jimmy, trying to get you, Jimmy. Jimmy, they're coming after you. Yeah, they're trying to get you, Jimmy, trying to get you, Jimmy. Every politician and his brother, too.
And spent the first 18 years of my life was always represented to me from the time I knew myself as a town whose glory days were behind it, when many ships would be in the harbor to load bananas, the green gold, for foreign ports. But it was always, as I knew it, and still is, I think, a kind of sleepy, shabby, beautiful but ramshackle place. Until one day in my school days, Errol Flynn rode into town, into the harbor, on his beautiful yacht, the Zacher, and he sort of took over the town for a time, and it became transfigured, became like a glamorous movie set, and we all thought we were going to be Hollywood stars. This poem is called The Town That Had Known Better Days. When Errol Flynn's Red MG raced like rumor through our town, scattering stray dogs and chickens, old rumheads slid from bar stools, lurched through swing doors, blinking into sunlight, just in time to catch the last puff of exhaust smoke. His pistol started raftsmen spurring their bamboo horses down the Rio Grande. Bets and bravado flew in bright air, and marlin leapt huge arcs of blue. At school, we envied the boy whose father landed a job as engineer. The level didn't matter on board the Zaka, which idled in the haven of our picturesque ramshackle port, like some exotic migratory seabird resting between oceanic flights. And we learned, to our befuddlement, that Eve, spelt differently, we were relieved to find, could be a man's name. When one of the slow, precociously pubescent girls who giggled at the back of the class waved her autograph book in our faces, showing off what a French boy, her boyfriend, so she said, a sort of junior cook on the yacht, I learned sous chef much later, what that French boy, Eve, had written. But that was nothing compared to the Bush Telegraph's frenzy when the wife of the moment, so it was said, took an ice pick to our girl next door turned Hollywood would-be. Sword fight for days. High swashbuckling jinx on the low seas. Badder than those Friday nights at the town's one cinema when the rude boys who couldn't find the fare for Pitt pounded their revenge on the zinc fence. Then, one day, news flash, heart stop, flim cut, star boy dead, the Seahawk strike again, and the place slipped quietly back to its proper identity, the town that had known better days. Yard boy. He wielded my boy word.
So far.
total breakdown of the clocks.
I wouldn't be seen dead with a living work of art. Nowadays, a fact is what has been translated into words of images. Those qualities, these forms to combine facts abstractly upon opinion, public face is wit.
Drop this jiggery pokery and talk straight turkey. The word is out.
What is that saying?
I'm not too awfully concerned about this. It's just a phase.
Massage. The medium is the massage.
Marshmallow, marshmallow. Yeah, how about that?
There'll probably be some music, but we'll manage to find a quiet corner where we can talk.
Professor McClure.
Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively posed, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result.
One, two, 1, 2, 3, 4.
The medium of our time,
electric circuitry,
profoundly involved men with one another. Information forced instantaneously, as soon as information is required, very rapidly, placed by still newer information. Our electrically configured world has forced us to move from the habit of data classification. No longer build passive recognition, block by block. We can no longer build serial, block by block, step by step. Because instant communication ensures that all factors of the environment and of experience coexist with a state of active intellect. Active intellect.
There ain't no grammatical errors in a non-literate society.
All media work us over completely. They are so pervasive in their
personal,
political,
economic,
aesthetic,
psychological,
moral,
ethical,
and social consequences that they leave no part of us untouched, unaffected, unaltered. The medium is the massage.
The medium is the massage.
Any understanding of social and cultural change is impossible without a knowledge of the way media work as environments.
Everything we do is music.
What you expect McLuhan will be doing once he's there next year or later this year?
We have, there's a friend of mine at Fordham who's on the faculty, and he's writing a booklet called What to Do Until McLuhan Comes.
Yeah.
We can't.
Well, the French make a distinction.
I believe it. I really believe it.
For another program.
But it's kind of incredible and things like that, right? Because he's a very unlikely hero in many ways.
Until writing was invented, man lived in acoustic space, boundless, directionless, horizonless, in the dark of the mind, in the world of emotion, by primordial intuition, by terror. Speech is a social chart of this law.
You can be anyone this time around. You can be anything this time around. You can be anything this time around. You can do anything this time around. You can be anyone this time around. You're the first generation in human history to know how to control your own nervous system, to change your own reality, blow your own mind, make up your own mind. You can be anything this time around. You can be God this time around. You've got to be God this time around. You can be anything this time around. You can be anyone this time around. You can be Krishna. You remember him. Body paint, barefoot, flute, standing down by the riverside, flirting with the cowmaids. Why not be Krishna, God of love this time around? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You can be Shiva this time around, sitting on your tiger skin, naked, waiting for your Shakti this time around. You can be Shiva, Om Shivaya, this time around.
Tell me again so I know what's happening in there, what's going on in your show. What was it you wanted? Say it again. I'll be back in a minute. Get it together, baby. What was it you wanted? You can tell me I'm back. We can start it all over. Get it back on the track. You got my attention. Go ahead, speak. What was it you wanted when you were kissing my cheek? Was it somebody looking when you gave me that kiss? Or someone there in the shadows, somebody I might have missed? Is it something you needed, something I don't understand? What was it you wanted? Is it here in my hand? Whatever you wanted slipped out of my mind. Would you remind me again? Would you be so kind? Has the record been breaking? Did the needle just skip? Is there somebody waiting? Is it a slip of the lip? What was it you wanted? I ain't keeping score. Are you the same person that was here before? Is it something important? Maybe not. What was it you wanted? Say it again. I forgot. Whatever you wanted, what can it be? Did somebody tell you that you could get it from me? Is it something comes natural? Is it easy to fake? Why do you want it? Who are you anyway? Is the scenery changing? Am I getting it wrong? It's all going backwards. Are they playing a song? Where were you when it started? Do you want it for free? What was it you wanted? Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me?
Underground was beginning to form its own alternative institutions, and among the most important, along with the underground press, was the Pacifica chain of radio stations, started in Berkeley. It later established stations in Los Angeles and New York, and still later in Houston. One of the early personalities on the Berkeley station, as Johnny Nighttime, was John Leonard, who was to become the editor of the New York Times Book Review. WBAI, the Pacifica station in New York, had an audience in the millions during the 60s and was always number one or two among New York FM stations at any hour of the day or night. Bob Fass had a late-night show called Radio Unnameable. This innovating, free-form program, which was sometimes a call-in show, was like a communications clearinghouse for what was coming to be called the counterculture, the switchboard for the underground community. Fass has a photograph from that period of me walking my dog, and the dog is taking a you-know-what, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and there's a crowd just gathering around to watch. As an index of popularity, that beats Bob Dylan, who once said that people at the Newport Festival would follow him into the men's room so they could watch him.
Listening to WBAI in New York City. This is Radio Unnameable, and we're also being heard this morning on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and in less than half an hour we'll be joined by WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. And of course we are streaming on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org and a couple of other places. If you are anywhere near a telephone and you want to get in touch with us, you can call us at 212-209-2900.
Thank you. Mighty Alpacas. You want to reach us, you can email me at tubajazz@hotmail.com. Again, that's tubajazz@hotmail.com. We'll be playing this Sunday afternoon in Carroll Gardens on Smith Street, 268 Smith Street, F4G Chain to Carroll. Thanks. Again, Jesse Dolman on tuba and Jason Candler on alto saxophone. Thanks.
Deadly seed. That's when the fun begins.
Well, don't blow it. This is your opportunity to give your message to the world. So that's all you have to say in your letter to the world?
Divorce. from the throne, from the throne.
Just a void and empty space. When you are not in my embrace. Oh, there's a lull in my life. The moment that you go away, there is no night, there is no day. The clock stops ticking. Everything stops, but that flame in my heart that keeps burning. You alone can end. ache in my heart. The call of my arms. The lull in my life.
That song and four others were recorded on my barge in Sausalito in 1953.
That was Chet Baker.
Ah. That was early Chet Baker. Good friend until he had that tragic disease which took so many of our jazz greats with him down the tracks in their arms and in other places in their bodies and in their heads and in their minds. But what a talent. This was right when he was coming out of the army in San Francisco. He was from Southern California, actually. I knew his parents also. Met him, actually, with Bird. What a combination. Anyway.
Cement and aluminum, fast open their skulls, and they up their brains and imagination.
Back with them.
Jed, you were with them in Rockland, weren't you?
No, I wasn't with them in Rockland, but I was with them in the Psychiatric Institute, which was before Rockland. He was alone in Rockland, except when Jack and Alan came to visit him to get him to sign a release so that he wouldn't sue about Howell, where they really rocked the boat pretty badly about, you know, what he supposedly did with his mother, which is maybe something that he said, but it certainly wasn't true, and it lost him his job, it lost him his
You're talking
mind.
About Carl Solomon.
I'm talking about Carl.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you were in the Psychiatric Institute with Allen Ginsberg and...
I was there first. And then Carl came, and then Alan came, yes. Carl came because he threw potato salad at Wallace Markfield, lecturing at NYU. And Alan came because his professors of literature thought he ought to go because he was being accused of stealing some Columbia University property and other kind
of... Defacing his windows.
And, you know, a lot of stuff and... after he had matriculated, and they felt it would be good for him.
That in itself sounds obscene.
But
matriculated.
Matriculated, right. It starts with Ma, you know, and as we know, his mother was kind of mad, but sad. I read Kaddish once at the Woodstock Festival, poetry festival, and we all cried. It's a very cryy poem. It's a wonderful piece of poetry, as is much of Alan. He's a great poet. He wasn't much of a human being, as far as I was concerned, but that's a different story.
That sounds fascinating.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't want to really get too deep into
it. Well, now that you've brought it up, you've... insinuated, you've got to...
I wasn't trying to insinuate. I was trying to... you know, Alan... Well, here's a piece from Ron's book, which is, I think, pertinent, where he says, any underground artist who wants to penetrate the mass market is either going to have to tailor his act or put up with the kind of merchandising reported in a recent New York Times article about people like Laurie Anderson, Philip Glass, and Eric Bogosian crossing over into the commercial mainstream. Much of the marketing strategy for a new film by Anderson, says the article, is convincing the public that the cutting edge does not hurt. The consequence is that not all, but most work directed to the mass market is going to be innocuous. The alternative course is to cultivate your own market, having your own audience of like-minded sympathizers. A base is one of the best defenses against being killed by mass market success, should the occasion ever arise. Alan's relationship to the market was odd. He had a penchant for putting people onto, well, for instance, the piece that he wrote for Esquire about India. He outed all the gurus and the musts in India for smoking what we, and many of us, and so many, and I'm the first one who turned Alan on, so I have certain inside information, let's put it, but that was a sad case, because Carl and I were very familiar, and Alan wasn't familiar at all. And we were in this psychiatric institute, and I got out for the weekends. And they were considered too dangerous to get out for the weekends, so they persuaded me that I should bring something into that sacrosanct venue, and okay, so I did it, and then they turned me in to the authorities, but and that was because they were aping Jean Genet, you know, who had turned in his criminal cohorts in France, and I got thrown out. I was ready to leave, so it was an amazing experience, and I had the only good psychiatric experience that I've ever had in my life, because the my doctor said to me, look, we're not going to see each other again. I'm a Freudian, and I'm not supposed to give people advice, right? And he said, but in this case, since I'm not going to see you again, I have something to say to you, he said. I'll tell you, you cannot live both the life that your father wants you to live and the life that you want to live, and you've got to make a decision. And I made it at that very moment, and I've been doing it ever since. And I did for a while get back in a relationship to my father before he passed, but it wasn't on his terms altogether. So that was a wonderful piece of advice, and I don't know whatever happened to Dr. Hambidge, but he did do what needed to be done for me.
Well, what was going on in your discovery of your real intentions and in the minds and hearts of the people who were intersecting with that change from bohemia to hippiedom? Was kind of, I mean, there was a lot of Freudian influence, and there was a lot of other.
Yeah, there was also so many influences. Even in the psychiatric world, there was Wilhelm Reich.
Wilhelm Reich, I was just going to say. Wilhelm Reich and an organ box.
That's right. Well, I never really got off on the organ box, because I never felt anything was happening to me. Although, you know, people, there were some big users, but the therapists who followed his work were fantastic. A lot of them were really effective in terms of treating your physical body as it appertained to your mind.
Well, an orgone box, as it was described, was like layers, a box composed of layers of organic and inorganic material.
That's true.
And in those days, there were telephone booths all around the city that were constructed that way.
Well,
so people would go into a telephone booth and have orgone therapy. And
but who were they talking to at the same time?
Well, it depends. It depends.
But don't you think that the method of therapy was remarkably effective, because all of us folks who have a way with words can, with word therapy, can weave our way in and out and just go on forever with the words and the excuses and the stories and so on. And Reichian therapy was remarkably, I thought, remarkably effective. I have to confess that I didn't have my own orgone box. In fact, one of my friends worked with Wilhelm Reich and was building orgone boxes. When Wilhelm Reich was thrown into jail, he was also jailed overnight for, I think it was for transport, going over state lines, sending orgone boxes over state lines. And he was in jail. Reich was in jail. I don't know if he died in jail, but he was in jail a long time. My friend, however, got out in a short period, a couple of days. But
but a lot of the ergotone therapy, the actual therapeutics, were very physical.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. I got held and tossed and... It absolutely destroyed my gag reflex. I used to have a gag reflex that if I stuck my finger in my mouth, everything came out, right? Everything for the last 24 hours. And after the therapist took me and shook me and opened my mouth so that I couldn't breathe and I couldn't laugh and I couldn't cry and kicking and screaming all the way without screaming, I've never had a gag reflex since, and it was a big relief. And he told me, let go. He said, let go like the cow plops by the river. And I didn't get it for at least 15 or 20 minutes, and my legs were kicking up in the air. You're nude, too, so, that's not an unusual thing to be, is it? We do that every night, or do you? I do. But I wasn't used to doing it with a therapist holding me down. He was wonderful. All those people that were into it, Paul Goodman, Bill Steig, Tashka Goldman from the Four Seasons.
Bill Steig, did you say Bill Steig? Yes.
Yes.
Right. Who wrote a book called Listen, Little Man, kind of about working therapy and the way in which one holds one's body is indicative of one's emotional state and the way you hold yourself in, like a military posture, indicates a certain kind of emotional stand and emotional withholding and tightness. When those things are pointed out, it's interesting how you zero in on that part of your body and the focus, all I can say is it was the most effective therapy I've ever been in, and I see people now in the 60s and 70s still going to talk therapists, and I wonder, why? What are you still talking about? Do you get bored with telling the same stories over and over and over and over again? It just sounds like a not only a waste of time, but a very dull time to me. But Reiki and therapy, did you know this Dr. Silverit? You didn't, okay.
I don't remember the doctor out in Long Island that I went to. I think you knew him, but
yes, probably.
Yeah, but I can't remember it. My name memory is slowly. I'm 81 years old. What can you expect? It comes back though, but slowly, not as.
Just about fall, my used to be come knocking on my door. She come crying, try me one more time. She was crying, daddy, try me one more time. She said, take me back, try me one more time. She said, I'll give you money, daddy, buy you clothes. I learned something, curl your toes. She was crying, try me one more time. She was crying, try me one more time. Oh, she said, take me back, daddy, try me one more time. I'll buy you clothes, give you money too. I'd do everything a girl could do for you. She was crying, Daddy, try me one more time. She was crying, try me one more time. She said, take me back, try me one more time. Daddy, I didn't do you right. I swear I'll rock you to sleep, baby. Every night she comes crying, try me one more time. She was crying, try me one more time. Well, she said, take me back, Daddy, try me one more time. I said, look here, Mama, it's a natural fact. It's you quit me, ain't gonna take you back. She was crying, try me one more time. She come crying, try me one more time. Oh, she said, take me back, Daddy, try me one more time. She said, take me back, try me one more time. Anything in the world for me. Boys, I got a kind-hearted woman. Girl, do anything in the world for me. Yeah, but you know these evil-hearted women. Oh, they just will not let me be. I was out in California. You know there was a great big rumbling on the ground. I was out in California, people. Oh, the earth was trembling all around. You know them people thought it was a big earthquake coming to get them. Lord, wasn't nothing but them evil-hearted women trying to run me down. Studies evil all the time. Boys, I got a kind-hearted woman. Girl studies evil all the time. You know, she tried to get my best friend to kill me just so he would have it on his mind. You know the deep are just the ones that make me want to drink. I swear it's how you treat me. I begin to think, oh, babe, my life don't seem the same. You know you break my heart when you call me by some other man's name.
Homethink is a process I can describe but not demonstrate for you. Describe but not demonstrate. First, about think. Do you know much how you think, how other people think, thunked, thoughted? How conscious thought your thoughts. Can you hear yourself thinking? You can. One way of thinking, an only way. If you can hear it, is it in words, thinking? I don't know if I think that most thinking is in words or can be heard. But the think, home think, I'm describing, not demonstrating, is in words. And when I poem think, I can hear it, inside hear it, if that's hearing. Sometimes I even catch myself moving my mouth, though I'm not speaking out, not out loud speaking. There's not a large literature on the mechanics of think as something to learn. There's lots on thought of all kinds, but how to think, to use the generators, switches, crossings, pardon the metaphors, semaphores, phosphors. Just how to think. Have you conversation, communication, learning, on think process? The next jump, with care in the presence, personal history, recollection, in re, collection. Ever since before, then when, it's been necessary for me to write down words, phrases, poem parts, wholes. Once up on that time, I thought, felt, heard, near that threshold where there's just so much you can remember, and you write to not let it spill into forgotten. As I in bed, lying, about to get up and grab for extensions, paper and lead, overstood that this moment with these words, moment with words all mine, connected me circuit around the positive, amplifying looped feedback to me circuit. Contact was and is. Contact is the only love circuit. In bed then, with my unnamed poem think riff, vanished, disappeared, but recognized, evanescent artifact, trace element, flashing imagination scan, follow or not to be, motion, enormous scale, off the balancing act between now and then. Sometimes you can keep it to yourself, 1, 2, 3, forever. Life, this time around, provides plenty, more or less, alone time. For instance, driving, waiting, being, and a lot of time around others,
not with them. Enough moment inertia, language compatible with your head, for poem think, mind wear. You, programmer, artificer, word stringer, however many you can fit, squeeze, allow, in this that moment of poem think consciousness, along a thread, through your maze head, on stretched, condensed line, jump rope words for each point in figure, nude of speech, geometric, catch it when it falls into your head, wrap or trap and go for it, reach high over, one follows another, piggyback, jump brother in the presence of a word care, center at pot wheel or scatter seed. You a mother word grabber, only if you do poem think, poem think, poem think, stuck on a noun in your deck, pinstripes and single breasteds, a little tight assed like the tropian cow by the stream, plop it, go, loosen word rein, or chop 'em into alphabet. Any foreign language, especially those you don't know well, a poem think fountain. Why? If you don't like it, you don't have to do it. Not like drugs, something you can make up your mind about without trying. Poem think, a totally different head than poem write, speak, read. Having described, not demonstrated, poem think, others have tried it, liked it and not, changed, added, used, it replicates. There's that how many question of holding like a bowl. How many letters, words, lines can you maintain, juggle, transform and back out of, momentum to loop, the Möbius strip, Klein bottle, Ryan tube, topology. Are you coming along or copping? Are you in poem think? Let's take five first poem thinks for everyone.
Signs all over. we march for voting rights, and end the bias now. No U.S. dough to help Jim Crow grow. The Interracial Marriage Club. The Capital Voters Association. We demand an end to police brutality now. We demand equal rights now. We demand an end to bias now. I see signs representing the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. We march for jobs for all now. Jim Crow has outlived its uselessness. Freedom now. The Englewood, New Jersey marchers. You want to say something, honey?
Hi.
Hi. Is that all you have to say?
Yes.
What are you doing here? Where are you from?
Florida. Florida. Deerfield Beach, Florida.
How long are you traveling to get up here?
I don't know. I forgot.
How'd you come, honey?
By train.
No, by car.
I mean by car.
How long did it take you to get here?
2 days and a night.
2 days?
Because we stopped over.
I see. Uh-huh. And how long are you going to stay? You're going to go right back after the...
Yes, we're going back.
The festivities?
Yeah. Going back to Florida.
And nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Oh, I can't. I saw a sign that said Mexico agrees.
I'm tired of holding this sign up. I'm going to throw it down.
Again, Brooklyn. Robert Jenkins from Brooklyn?
From Brooklyn.
We demand end to bias, decent housing now, Brooklyn core.
Good.
And you're getting tired of holding that up?
No.
Well,
yes, I am. Yes, I am. I'll be frank with you.
Well, you've been holding it up.
I've been holding it up all the way through this crowd and down the street.
It's been needed for 100 years.
Well, that's what we are trying to seek now.
We're hoping it doesn't take another 100 to come.
I hope it doesn't.
We want it now.
We want it. That's what we are asking for.
Thank you very much.
1963. Okay. March on Washington.
That's it.
Which?
You got me swinging.
You got me running. You got me hiding. You got me run, hide, hide, run. Any way you want, let it roll. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got me doing what you want me. Oh, baby, what you want me to. You got me up. You got down. You got me up, down, down, up. Any way you want, let it roll. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got me doing what you want me. Baby, what you want me to.
Play one.
Thank you.
Really
yeah.
Good. I got off on that.
Thank you.
As Ron wrote, during the 60s, half of America joined the underground, mostly the younger half, the hipsters and beats, however inadvertently, spawned hordes of hippies who inaugurated the youth culture. As much as it represented a genuine movement of personal and even political liberation, the youth culture became a means of merchandising the underground and vitiating it as a form of resistance. Thanks to the underground, Romeo and Juliet grew up with more liberal ideas about personal lifestyle, which modified middle-class values to produce a looser, more adaptable hippoisie. The underground had its impact on, and much of it was simultaneously co-opted by, the establishment. But as with sex, there was a long moment of genuine rebellion before the whole counterculture was digested by the consumer society. One of the essential ingredients was the sexual revolution. When the sex bomb hit, the scene became something unbelievable to someone like me who had grown up in the 50s. Some people claim they were getting it three times a night. They would just go off to someone's apartment and then come back. Some of the inner circle would use the office. Some people would use phone booths. Some would use the bathroom floors. Even the bar was not unknown as a place for hardcore. In an amazing reversal of manners, women would try to pick me up. And not only women. I remember an odd campy dance Andy pulled on me, smiling before he'd let me get past him one night. My unique experience of gay pursuit till Jimmy Baldwin started chasing me around the revolving door at the entrance to the Dial Press building. It's difficult to describe the erotic intoxication that took hold in those years. It was like Wilhelm Reich a go-go, especially concerning his ideas about free adolescent sexuality, the ones that shocked even me when I read them as an adolescent. Now, the interesting thing about this book is that it was published in 1987. Now, personally, I don't know whether some of it was written much earlier, but I think, is it true, Gloria, that by that time Ron was actually a professor in Colorado at the university?
No, he wasn't in Colorado. I think he may have been in California. Uh-huh. He was in California for a little while. 87. He may have been in Colorado. Actually, it's true. Although it seems unusual to me because so his life was so altered at that in Colorado. I mean, he really did become part of the academic establishment to a degree.
You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
I can't hear the radio. I just got disconnected, so I haven't heard what you said for the last 3 minutes or something like that.
You just got disconnected from the radio?
Yes, I listen online.
I see.
Don't have a radio.
I see. Where are you?
Brooklyn.
Wow, we're on the internet in this is WBAI in New York City. We're also being heard over KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York. And you're listening in Brooklyn.
Oh my God, how do you remember that? Do you write it down or you just know that?
I used to have to write it down, but now I remember it.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
When you called, you had something that was imperative.
I just made a video, another one, about the local station board meeting.
Oh.
And I want to tell people where to find them. There are 8 of them now. 10-minute videos on YouTube.
On the WBAI local station board.
Yes, I hope so. In this hot weather, I really don't know what city I'm in, but yeah. And
there was a meeting today at the station that went on all day, wasn't there?
I think there was a finance committee meeting today. But there's some other kind of meeting. Yeah, there was some other kind of meeting.
And there is a new station manager for WBAI.
That's what I heard.
Berthold Reimer.
Right. Berthold Reimers.
Reimer.
And his name is spelled B-E-R-T-H, please. B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D.
Berthold.
Yes. But as an H.
As in Brecht.
I think he's Haitian.
Okay.
Anyway, can I say where to find the videos? I don't give out a URL because I think it's easier if you just go to YouTube, you know, and YouTube.com and type in the search bar of YouTube, not of your web browser. Type in first 10 minutes WBAI, just those 4 words, and you will find... You will get 10 little projects. And the one I just finished, what did I call it? I called it Magicians of the Apocalypse, referring to certain members of the local station board who have an ability to say something. It's like an emperor's new clothes kind of thing. To say something that manifestly isn't true, and their supporters will not contradict them, and their opponents will not contradict them because they're so damn tired of them saying the same thing so consistently all the time. Nobody has any energy, and that's what...
That's less, what democracy is all about.
Really? Is this what...
That's right. That's right. Confusing the electorate by statements that are often unrelated to the truth, wouldn't you say?
Yes, but it's
from ancient Greece to today.
It's quite shocking to see it being done in front of you. You see, and
but then after a while, as you say, you get used to it.
No, you never get used to it. You get tired of it. I mean, I'm not on the board. I'm not supposed to interrupt. If I was on the board, I would not be tired of shouting them down. But not the board, not the other people. And they must be so much more tired than me.
Well, if we go to the YouTube where your videos are, we'll see what you're talking about, right?
Yes, there'll be 8. You'll find 8 videos, including the one called Magicians of the Apocalypse. I like that title. They're all under 10 minutes, you know. YouTube only allows videos of less than 10 minutes unless you're grandfathered in before they made the rule some people were there already, but I wasn't. And also I want to announce my non-candidacy after running for the local station board 3 times. I will no longer, at least not this year, I cannot make videos and run for the board at the same time. It's just incompatible, and I'm sorry about that. My name is Albert Solomon, and so I will not be a candidate. And I want to announce that, my non-candidacy.
Well, all right, Albert Solomon.
Well, nice talking to you, Bob.
Thank you for calling us.
Yeah, thank you. And I enjoyed the music, except I got, as I said, I'm disconnected now, and I have to do something to get, sometimes it disconnects like this, and then you can't get it back. You have to restart the computer or something.
Well, I don't know why that happened, but, maybe our chief engineer does.
Yes. Oh, I had one other point I wanted that you sort of brought up, the web. How many people are listening on the web? How many are listening right now? 7? I mean, I wish there should be like a clock in the studio showing how many are listening right now and the average for the last, maybe a computer screen with a graph. Showing something like that.
But that's been the mystery of electric radio ever since it began. You're on the air, and you never know who or what is happening out there unless you, Alan Solomon, call in, Now, we have no idea of the compatibility of the rest of the listenership. I was with KPFA from the beginning, practically.
Oh, and what's your name?
My name is Geert Stern.
Geert Stern.
And that was the mystery which we enjoyed so much, because at the beginning, we had very few listeners, but somehow it seemed like it was much more. But as the listenership built up, and it built up very quickly, as soon as we were able to get FM sets out, because at the beginning it was at the very start of FM, and very few people had the capacity to listen, and of course there were no computers. So it was a lot of fun to hypothecate what was going on out there in what we called electric radio land.
Yes, but excuse me, if you'll excuse me, I was talking about the web stream. We do know how many people listen on the web stream.
Do we?
I assume.
How does that work?
Because there's a web server, a computer. And the computer is yours, I would think. Or it's either ours or someone we rented it from. And computers are able to calculate, to count and tabulate websites, and so I'm assuming that's true. I might be wrong, but...
I think you're right about the capability, but whether that count is available, for instance, to WBAI...
I'm suspicious, because there is a person, I think there's a web page where you can get the count for now, this minute.
That's amazing. Interesting.
Yeah, but maybe I'm cynical or skeptical, but I wish it was not for this minute. But I mean, it's a computer. It should have a graph for the whole day, for the week, for the year, for the program. So you could know something about it. And
1, 2, 3 forever.
Well, nice meeting you, Gerd. I don't think I've heard of you. What type of programming did you do?
You mean in the old days?
Well, I think you said you were a programmer or a host?
Producer. We did a lot of cultural stuff. The beginnings of KPFA were much heavier on the cultural And that included, of course, music and all of the arts. The political, of course, was present, but in a very minority kind of way compared to what it is now.
Really?
Oh, yes. I mean, Lou Hill was not really a political animal. Although he wanted to be president of the United States, but KPFA was only the beginning shot that he took at that. And he never got beyond that, tragically.
I see. Who was that guy with the single tax? I forgot his name.
Oh, yeah.
He ran for mayor, I think. He wasn't successful, but somebody who... I wouldn't want to be president from my experience at Pacifica Radio.
I would
be the dictator. I envision myself as a certain point in history. There will be a point where the president of the United States gets assassinated every 3 or 4 hours. So there's a big need for people, and then maybe I would take a shot at that.
I see. Well, Lou was convinced that the presidency and the entire impetus in this country had to be a cultural phenomenon, and that a tradition of culture was what this nation rested on, and he was determined that it was his need and his desire and his ability to make that happen in this country. And unfortunately, due to other circumstances, he suicided.
Yes, I
very, very, very disillusioning phenomenon to a lot of people, including myself.
Wow. So you knew him?
Very well.
Oh, really?
Lou was a poet, and I'm a poet, and we used to print poetry and read poetry together, so yes, we were close.
Was that you reciting poetry tonight? Or?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Your voice sounds different when you recite. You were talking about the poetry mind or something?
The poem think.
Poem think, yes.
Yes, that was it. But that wasn't me reading tonight. That was
I see.
That was a recording done.
It sounded like somebody else.
In fact, I haven't heard it for many years, and I was amazed.
It was you reading on recording?
Yes.
I see. Yeah, my voice is getting hoarse when I narrate the videos. I have to rest up next time, but I was trying to get it done before my birthday.
Well, good luck, and I will certainly take a look at your videos.
And yep. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
When is your birthday?
It was actually June 21st.
Oh, the first day of summer.
But we're having a birthday party on Saturday. So I'm going to cook, and supposedly, I can't believe all these things are going to happen, but it's really...
You weren't by any chance related to Carl.
Who?
Carl Solomon.
No, Solomon is a fairly common name.
Oh, I know.
I'm really not in touch with any of my relatives.
I see. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go on to another call.
All right. Well, thank you. Nice talking to you, Gerd.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Yes.
You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, just who you want to hear from. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Well, I just saw the movie Gasland. It was on HBO.
Ah.
So two cheers for HBO. Josh Fox is very good. These people are murderers. And, they're probably getting profits off the murders if they're saying they're safe. But a few things about BP, the BP spill.
Yes.
So it really seems to me that it's true that BP was, you know, totally negligent and all that. You can't expect corporations to be honest if you don't watch them like hogs. But at this point, Robert Reich is right that the president should absolutely take command over the whole thing.
He should nationalize BP. That's the first thing he should do.
We'll put them in receivership. It's probably easier. Nationalizing is a little more complicated legally.
Especially since they're an international organization. Yeah.
Right. Well, BP USA. But they could... there's the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. It's very clear. It states that the president shall... Even if there's an imminent threat to habitats, which has gone beyond imminent threat to being actual destruction already, the president can commandeer resources. He can have all workers supplied with respirators mandatorily and overseen by the federal government.
And all the pelicans supplied with respirators.
Well, no, I mean, in other words, whatever the things that are, that can be done in terms of mobilizing the reaction can be done effectively. Apparently, the BP is doing a terrible job. And if word is coming in, CNN has done a good job of covering it.
Yes, they
Anderson can. Cooper, Blue Eyes. And, no, all the local parishes and so forth, they there's lots more they could have. I mean, the president could bring together all the oil companies and different manufacturers and say, look, we want you to manufacture this kind of a purification machine that Kevin Costner developed or financed the development of, and we want to produce enough respirators so all the workers have the proper protection, and they have people going out there with training and so on and so forth. I mean, Even the plugging of the well, you could rely on BP's experts, but you don't have to rely on BP, as Robert Reich is pointing out.
Great, thank you. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Noel.
You're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the radio.
Oh, let me turn down my radio. There we go. Yes, I've been enjoying the program very much this evening. And I'm calling to beg of all of you and the listening audience to pray for a friend of mine, if I might. I'm not really the praying type, but in this case, if everybody could pray for my friend Jody, who I just found out today that she caught something when she was in high school, and apparently it's incurable, and she has something crawling around inside her pussy.
I'm sure it was you.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. What are you playing, Bob?
Well, it's called Walking Stick.
Wow. Wait, I got an extra radio I just turned off. I got to play two radios because one of them is going dead. But I caught you only in the last 10 minutes. I had some jobs to do downstairs. But I like that fellow you were talking to, that Solomon guy.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I kind of feel the way he does. And it's very disheartening when you hear these kind of, they seem to not know what they're doing. They just go on, and it's like a force you don't know how to divert. It keeps refueling itself. As you were saying, they don't make a lot of sense, but they just do a lot of obfuscating and interrupting, and it's like a mindless energy, and it's very distressing. I just wish we had more quiet people like you and subtle people that could really not be so ambitious to be ruling others. I just find that so, the very people that shouldn't be ruling, they should rule themselves, and they don't know how to. So how can they rule others, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do.
Well,
I think I do.
I don't want to be sad tonight because it's not really good for me. I have to be kind of positive, what with those G20s up there. And when you see what the 20 is, it's almost like they rotate the 20. Some are real countries, some are would-be, wannabe. And one of the so-called people is just called European Union. What do you think of that? The whole European Union is a country. Or at least their administrative body. That's considered a separate country. What do you think of that, Bob? I thought that was peculiar.
Well, it's I don't know, more of a, more worthy, say, than Halliburton or some corporation.
Oh, please, Halliburton is so unworthy. Let's not bring them up. Ooh, can you just imagine? They're the ones in charge of that platform, and it never was a good platform to begin with. That's what we're hearing. That so-called platform, they knew it was shoddily done, and they just cover it up. Did you hear that joke on, I think it was Cat Radio? They now call them Bhopal, just like the disaster in India, where no executives got more than 2 years and people are still blind and suffering, and what do they give a darn? You know?
Is that, you say that's a joke?
No, they did it as a joke on the Cat Radio little musical they did today. You didn't catch it?
I did, actually. I heard it.
Well, one little line, I don't really mean it was a joke. I'm speaking kind of broadly. They did it in a sarcastic or sardonic way, but...
Satiric, you mean.
Satiric, thank you. That's better. So it reminded you in a very quick way how revolting the whole thing is, you know, to remind you of all these disasters. And since I listen to other channels and I hear more and more depressing information, I need to hear you. I always listen to you, at least part of your program. I try never to miss you week to week, so at least I've tuned in now, and it was positive to hear your friend Garrett, is his name?
Gerd,
beautiful name. Yeah, so there is a good history behind Pacifica, and I think we should try to have hope that this entity will survive, it notwithstanding the bad things that are occurring. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And
well,
so,
you know, Bob, when I came to New York after many years in California, and I listened to Bob, here I've been reading about how Bob listened to the BAI at first, but when I listened to Bob, he represented for me what Pacifica was all about, what Lou had intended
I agree
to be.
Yep.
And I had a very hard time identifying much else. There were some other people, so don't get me wrong that I would isolate Bob. But it's very difficult to understand the intention, you know, of anybody's intention to do something which is so media-centric.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was much easier in the old days because, for instance, FM just didn't exist.
Yeah.
When it started out, it was an open book, but it's now basically extant commercial enterprise with a little bit of ourselves, of Pacifica and college stations, with what we always think of as a minority audience. Now, I was fascinated by Ron Sukenick's statement that in the 60s, billions of people listened to WBAI. It never occurred to me that millions of people listened to it. Did it occur to you, Bob?
Well, it was true.
I think it was.
I thought a lot of us listened.
But
and we liked everybody then because we understood, and what he was playing was what we wanted to hear, and the attitude, and it was as though we had an ear to our soul right there on BAI, and why would you miss it? It was just so, you needed it. It was your life energy.
But can you imagine what it would have been if millions of people had subscribed to WBAI?
I can imagine, because they didn't beg as much then. They had those wonderful parties, and they did it so unorthodox, but so wonderful. You couldn't dislike anybody. At least I don't remember too much of that. Everybody was so eager to keep it going, and I thought that was my feeling. It was a very positive thing to tune in to Pacifica.
Do you remember when women's consciousness raising groups were held on WBAI radio?
I do, and I thought that we were all pretty interesting. I didn't feel there was too much of exclusion in those years. We were just so eager to be on the air and doing the things that the producers were doing, and we felt part of it. I know I did. I can think of a lot of females that were on the air then, and if they weren't doing one thing, they were doing another. But then again, certain programs stuck out, like, you know, Radio Unnameable. The whole title was so great. Yeah, it's unnameable. It's the unknown. It's everything you want and dream about.
Do you remember Paul Gorman?
Of course.
Yes.
I remember James. Is it James?
Thursday.
He was on the air not
recently.
So
yeah.
Yeah. And I was so missing him when he went away, and now it seems he's back. But these were great. I thought, what good programming. I mean, it was, I didn't think it was ordinary. I thought it was a great station. I don't think, the only other programs I used to listen to was classical and country music. So if it wasn't music, it had to be BAI. That would be the only other thing in those years I would listen to. In the evening, because in the daytime we all had to do other crap.
We're on the air, too.
I go to school and work.
Hello?
Yes, hello. With the obsession of Bertold Riemer as program, as station manager, this is great news. I exhort everyone who pledged during the drive to throw in a couple of more dollars to give Bertold Riemer, who is a brilliant human being with a heart and soul and a consciousness and intelligence that will take this station, I don't know where, to greater heights, I'm hoping. And I think he will. I met him, quote unquote, at one of the local station board meetings about 5 years ago. He was a member of the board, and the things that he said were exactly what BAI's mission is in the world. And then he became the chairperson of the war, and then the faction that did not like him, you know, got him out of there. And now, look where he is. I am so happy. I think people should pledge some $10 maybe right now on the web, or send a check to the station, WBAI Pacifica, 120 Wall Street. Do it now, because WBAI is about to take off.
That's good. I know Bertold. Lovely guy.
That's right.
Just like the guys on the air tonight. He's so soft-spoken and even-tempered. And
you're on the air.
Oh, wonderful program, Bob. Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yeah.
Go on. More of the same.
Well, it's just wonderful. It's like tuning in 1968 all over again. And wonderful poetry. I just never heard anything so beautiful. And the story about Allen Ginsberg fascinates me. And I just wonder, does Jared have a Bob Dylan story?
That's very interesting. I don't know if you noticed that earlier in the evening or in the night, Bob played a classical pianist named Nina Deutsch. She lives in New Jersey. She's played all over the world, in China, in Europe, etc. She got permission from Bob to play his music in classical piano, and she's quite a more than confident, quite a wonderful pianist. Unfortunately, her idea that young people would listen to this because it was Dylan, I don't think is really Dylan heads want to hear the words, you know. They don't want to, just want to hear a piano playing. But it is an interesting exercise. Dylan stories. Oh dear, Woodstock, 1970s, more or less. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think 1970s. A bunch of us are standing on the lawn outside of the house, and right in front of a big picture window at a party. There's a lot of people standing in front of the window, including my wife at the time, who's no longer alive. And a guy comes up with a shotgun and says he had just bought it and he was showing it off. And Bob says, let me see that. And he hands it to him, and Bob points it at the window, and I knock it down. And people say, Garrett, what are you doing? I said, hey, does anybody know whether that gun is loaded or not? We used to swim in his pool. He was very nice about letting us swim in his pool. Because Bob Dacey, who, if you listened earlier to the Tim Leary album, which Bob Dacey and I edited, Dace was living right above Dylan's house up on
Fantastic.
Birdcliff, right?
Birdcliff, you got it. That's the word I was looking for, Birdcliff. And Birdcliff still exists. But we were doing a multimedia show at the Woodstock Artists Association, and Bob was standing behind us. We were working the projectors and the sound and mixing everything. And Bob said, Garrett, could you explain to me what you're doing? And I looked at him and I said, If you were on stage and I said to you what you just said to me, you think you could answer? I don't know. We weren't friends by any means. We just knew each other.
I have a little Bob Dylan story. When he first started out and he was performing on, I think it was on Bleecker Street, just started to make a name for himself. There was a young man who was absolutely fascinated by Bob Dylan, and he lived down the street on Sullivan Street, I believe, and this young man used to go through his garbage every night just to see what he was doing, what he was throwing out, what he was up to, and it became kind of a very contentious deal. I think.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Do you remember the you do?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
They all like garbage. But Bob, but let me ask you another question. Who sang? What was it you wanted? Who was that?
Oh, it was Chris Smither.
Chris Smither, wonderful. Well, thank you very much. I love your program.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye bye.
Be well.
Yield and overcome. Bend and be straight. Empty and be full. Wear out and be new. Have little and gain. Have much and be confused. Therefore the wise embrace the one and set an example to all. Not putting on a display, they shine forth. Not justifying themselves, they are distinguished. Not boasting, they receive recognition. Not bragging, they never falter. They do not quarrel, so no one quarrels with them. Therefore the ancients say, yield and overcome. Is that an empty saying? Be really whole, and all things will come to you. To talk little is natural. High winds do not last all morning. Heavy rain does not last all day. Why is this? Heaven and earth. If heaven and earth cannot make things eternal, how is it possible for man? He who follows the Tao is at one with the Tao. He who is virtuous experiences virtue. He who loses the way is lost. When you are at one with the Tao welcomes you. When you are at one with virtue, the virtue is always there. When you are at one with loss, the loss is experienced willingly. He who does not trust enough will not be trusted. He who stands on tiptoe is not steady. He who strides cannot maintain the pace. He who makes a show is not enlightened. He who is self-righteous is not respected. He who boasts achieves nothing. He who brags will not endure. According to followers of the Tao, these are extra food and unnecessary luggage. They do not bring happiness. Therefore, followers of the Tao avoid them.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee. Deep in the earth. Cover me with
Band, the Mighty Alpacas, the drummer's out of town right now, but my name's Jesse Dolman, I'm playing the tuba, and Jason Candler's playing the alto saxophone.
Howdy.
We are very happy to be here at this early, late hour. Again, we'll be performing this Sunday at 2:45 p.m. to 3:45 at a outdoor music festival on Smith Street in Carroll Gardens. Effort G Train to Carroll Street, 268 Smith is where I'll be this Sunday at 2:45. Thanks.
Along with the identifications, I guess I should say this is WBAI in New York City, and we're also being heard on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York, and streaming on the World Wide Web.
Our streets are filled with violence. Our streets are filled with crime. Every time you turn your radio on, bad news most of the time. White race hating the black race. The black race hating the white. You ought to throw the race hate down. Walk in the gospel light. Well, ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? We the people do. Well, our young men are dying on the bloody battlefield. Mothers and fathers are losing the son. I know about how they feel. Hearts are filled with sorrow. The eyes are filled with tears. The wicked fighting ought to be stopped. That's going on through the years. Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? The way the people do. Well, fighting is not the answer. Not ammunition and guns. If we'd all live right for God, that would put the devil on the run. Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? The way the people do. People are quitting the churches. Some say God is dead. My God, can I die? The people are out of their head. Talk about fighting and killing. They shouldn't be thinking of such. Got the whole world living in fear because they're killing so much. Well, ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame? Ain't it a shame?
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee.
Did you see the... movie on Point of View this week by William Kunstler's two daughters was really quite wonderful. Emily and Sarah, I think their names are, and they showed what it was like to have a father who was dedicating his life to defending some that you might think of as indefensible. Ended the film with the vindication of the young men who had been accused of the Central Park jogger case. Actually, what should have happened if William Kunstler had been alive, I hope what would have happened was that the lying police and the lying district attorneys had been would have been prosecuted for their miscarriage of justice. But Kunstler was a great, great man. And if you get a chance to see this film about William Kunstler, do not miss the opportunity.
And your war. You're telling me it'll last a lifetime, maybe more. You build up the war chest, let the country fall apart. Behind that brave face, you got a lion heart. You kill our soldiers, innocent children, families, with rogue chemical bombs, raining fire and disease. Collateral damage, yeah, that's what I hear you say. Like it's the new American way. No, not in our name. Not in our name. For all your crimes against humanity, ain't no mandate you can claim. No, not in our name. Not in our name. And you can spin all your wheels, but all I feel is my patriotic shame. You foul the airwaves, your propaganda lies. Like war brings peace, and stupidity is wise. Like you're protecting freedom in those secret torture jails. Or if your death squads, whenever all else fails. No, not in our name. Not in our name. For all your crimes against humanity, ain't no mandate you can claim. No, not in our name.
You're on the air.
Not in our name.
Hello? Hello.
Okay, are we on?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, I just want to say that a great German philosopher wrote a couple hundred years ago that to appeal to common sense when insight and science fail, and no sooner, this is one of the subtle discoveries of modern times, by means of which the most superficial ranter can safely enter the list of the most thorough thinker and hold his own. For what is it but an appeal to the opinion of the multitude, of whose applause the philosopher is ashamed, while the popular charlatan glories and confides in it?
Who was this philosopher?
Immanuel Kant.
Immanuel Kant. I think he's right. Don't you?
Well, of course, I'm a follower.
Well, it's not just Kant.
What's that?
I said it's not just Kant.
Yeah, well, no.
It's more like Can.
I think I get your point.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah. Yeah. This I remember from when I was a teenager. Many, many years ago. So I still remember it. And it got me in the right direction from that time when I was confused about history and which direction I should take then. So he was a great influence on me.
Did you read it in English or in the original language?
In English. In English.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I ultimately went on to study Hegel. Hegel is much more of a complete thinker than Kant. I don't know if you read The Logic.
Somewhat. Did you eventually get to Wittgenstein?
No, because it took the rest of my life to understand Hegel.
Okay.
Yeah. Eventually, the problem was of objective reality, which involved the whole the negation of being, and then double negation, and then the whole Hegelian dialectics.
Yeah, I've been very involved with recently with editing a lot of Huey P. Newton's work, which I recorded in the 70s, and he was a big student of Hegel's. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No.
Especially the negation of the negation was something that he caught on. Yeah, he studied it in Oakland, California. It's an amazing kind of a Hegelian application to revolutionary suicide.
Revolutionary suicide?
Well, that's one of Huey's preoccupations, yes. But he got it from Hegel.
Well, Hegel is often misinterpreted. It's very difficult. This is from the doctrine of being, which precedes the doctrine of the notion, which is the absolute or absolute reason.
Yeah. So I mean, to take it from that perspective, which was Hegel's and his time and his place, and to apply it to a Black Panther kind of philosophy, to me was a kind of an incredible jump, and intellectual jumps are so fascinating that they can be applied to conditions which are so disparate from the conditions that they came out of, the negation of the negation.
Well, that's what Karl Marx did.
Uh-huh.
But he inverted Hegel, he stood him in his head.
That's true.
Yeah, which is mostly what most revolutionaries have done, was to stand Hegel on his head. It's a misuse of the dialectics.
And the blood rushes to the brain.
Yeah. Hegel, at the very beginning of Logic, wrote, "Logic is the science of the pure idea. Pure, that is, because it is in the abstract medium of thought. If you identify the idea with thought, thought must not be taken as a method of form, but as the self-developing totality of his laws and peculiar terms, These laws are the work of thought itself and not a fact which it finds and must submit to.
Wow.
This is on the very first page of the logic.
Hey, you've obviously spent the year.
A whole lifetime.
Yeah.
A lifetime. But it was a lifesaver for me because I got heavy into Buddhism and I was lost. I was lost there. I just had no motivation to do anything. Well, I spent years in meditation.
That's very interesting that you say that because Huey was also into Zen because our mutual friend Richard Baker, and he had a lot of colloquies. Richard is also very well educated in the philosophers that you have studied. So Zen has a kind of a ability to cope with that, which some of the other Buddhist sects don't, is my thought about it. I don't know if you agree.
Well, the problem that for me was that I was in this empty state of mind where I couldn't do anything, and I was literally starving to death. I almost died. Because I was poor. I didn't have any money.
Yeah, well, I've been there.
And if you don't work and you don't produce food, you're going to die. And in that Buddhist state of mind, that's what happens. And there I was in an abandoned building, and it was winter, and I came close to it. But I just had no motivation to do anything.
Well, very odd. Very odd. I don't know that story.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the drawbacks of Zen. I'm talking about the actual experience of Zen, not just the words or the poetry.
Well, were you alone?
At that point, yes, because I had gone through the Cartesian method.
Yeah,
I don't know if you don't understand the Cartesian method.
More or less, but
Descartes was alone.
Uh-huh.
Once he stripped himself of everything.
But in Zen, being alone is not a state which is possible for anyone who participates. You know, you can't sit alone.
Well, I was going to Buddhist meditations.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, I went to all the Buddhist meditations, but at that point, they were trying to achieve something that I already achieved, so communication was not possible.
Well, you're
I was in a peaceful state of mind.
Yeah, well, you're lucky to have come out of it.
Well, my mother saved me.
If it wasn't for my mother,
I would have died.
That is wonderful.
Yeah. My mother was there for me; otherwise, I was dead. I was gone.
Very interesting.
I couldn't do a thing. But then reading Hegel, I saw the possibility of double negation. So that gave me hope that it was possible to get out of that Zen state. That's what I was trying to do so that I could survive. At that point, it was just a matter of survival. Zen is great if you have a support system.
That's very interesting.
And enough food.
I meant to bring tonight a CD of Huey talking about the negation of the negation, but I somehow didn't find it in time to get here. So you bringing this up.
You'll have to come again.
Yes, I'll come again. Or maybe I'll just breathe hard.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how he applied it.
If
you breathe for more than 4 hours, you have to go to an emergency room.
Oh, you mean hyperventilate.
Because, see, that when I was in college, my professor of moral philosophy applied it differently. And he was a Marxist. So he was absolutely nonviolent. He thought that the negation of negation led to nonviolence, ultimately. Achievement of the highest good, you know, which meant also, I think Kant said, you need the greatest good, happiness.
Yeah, well, Huey agreed with that, but the problem with him personally is that he had a horrible streak of potential.
A what?
a horrible streak of potential violence.
So did I.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so did I. The Zen did help.
Well, it killed him, and thank God it didn't kill you.
It almost did, because I was hanging out with a rough lot then. And I was going in the direction of Che Guevara at that point, before I reached that Zen state. I had a very violent nature, but you know that sort of cleared me of it. But then I ran into this other problem of survival. So, but you see, if you read the...
So how old are you?
Close to your age.
Thank you.
Very close.
Well, it seems like you've done okay at surviving so far.
So far, yeah. But still, like, you know, I have the...
better than
I'm
many.
I'm sorry I didn't go to Cuba, for instance. I should have gone to Cuba when I had a chance.
Well,
now I can feel the oppression of capitalism, you know, when I have to go through all that.
Well, you know, Huey was in Cuba.
Yeah. But he didn't stay there.
Well, he was there for a while, but, you know, he wanted to come back to be active in the U.S., and he was able to make a deal to get out of the political situation that he was in, he escaped to Cuba. He didn't just go there for to visit.
Well, that's what I intended to do. And I'm sorry now that I'm older that I didn't do it. I missed my chance, and now I have to go through all that. Oppressive, hierarchical, you know, just people stepping on me, you know.
Well, I mean, if you think back and you wonder how Kant and Hegel managed to exist in their cultures and in their time. It must have been very difficult for them, wouldn't you say?
I would say that they were quite isolated. They had no influence whatsoever on what Kant called the multitude. And they Descartes, for that matter, because he found himself to be alone. After after Cogito Ergo Sum, he goes on to... to logically prove the existence of God, and then he writes, if you read the Meditations, God exists, I am not alone.
You know, I just did a pun on that Cogito. We've written an opera called Psyche and Delia about the psychedelic period, and the final phrase which I wrote there is Cogito ergot sum.
Well, I think, therefore, we are leaving. We're going to be out of here in a few minutes. Time for Ahmed Ali, Ibrahim Gonzalez,
Ibrahim.
In the moment. And it's been enlightening this morning.
Definitely heady.
Lightning.
I thought it was pleasant.
Levity is what I'm talking about here, and I thank you very much for your call.
Yes,
it was a terrific show tonight, Bob.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. You have
really enjoyed your guest.
Excellent taste. Excellent taste.
Now, you gave us a very nice finale.
Well, I hope you come back.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm
always
coming
something.
Back.
Yeah.
So be well.
I'm going to do a rock and roll song from 1960, that year of fame. The year Nixon almost won. This is from early 1960, when I first got to New York. I was working, I got a job, you know, in his place, and they had a radio, and that's where I heard it, because this radio was on WINS. And it's called... Handyman is recorded by Jimmy Jones.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.